Well, hi, I'm Matt, one of the Maybridge staff. Delighted to have you join us, whether you're young or old or tall or short or whatever. You're very welcome. As a church, we're slowly walking through the New Testament book known as Matthew's Gospel. And this is part three. And today, the story might be familiar to you, even if you're not somebody who would identify as a follower of Jesus. We're looking at Matthew chapter 2. This is where, after Jesus was born, he is visited by some so-called wise men. And it might depend how old you are, but when I was little, this was a big feature of Christmas. You did the school nativity and everyone would sort of jostle for position. Being Mary or Joseph was the best thing. If you couldn't make it as one of them, then the next thing was being one of the three kings. It was always three, not sure why, but it always was. And I bet because of that, many of us are familiar with the idea of three kings or wise men visiting Jesus in a stable. Of course, it's not Christmas right now, which means away from all the usual brilliant Christmas stuff, we can look at this story with a bit more space and see there's actually loads going on here that might not be obvious straight off. So let's have a look. Start with Matthew chapter 2. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. Very straightforward line. This is quite important. There's a number of places called Bethlehem in ancient Israel. It literally just means house of bread. But this is specific about which Bethlehem. This is the Bethlehem in the Judea region. We'll come to why this is important. It's just outside the capital city of Jerusalem, about 5 or 6 miles sort of to the south. It was also during the reign of King Herod. You might remember him from the school nativity as well. Why is Matthew telling us this? Well, partly it was very common to give this sort of detail when you were reporting ancient historical events, like saying who the ruler was at the time and so on. But I think it's also the case that early in the book, Matthew is doing what any great storyteller would do. He's established that Jesus is the hero, he's the main character in the book. And now, pretty early on, he's introducing the villain, the bad guy. Or actually, more specifically, he's introducing a family of villains. You see, there's actually a number of Herods in the New Testament. They're all, to be honest, they're all pretty horrendous human beings. This particular Herod was known as Herod the Great. He wasn't particularly great, but he was very powerful. Herod the Great. The other Herods that we read about in the New Testament are his kids, just to make that clear. Now, we don't have time to go into all of them right now, but let's just say you would not want to spend time socially with any of the Herods. None of them. They're just a really, really rotten, horrible bunch. But Herod the Great is an important figure. He's the king of Israel at the time, but he's a puppet king. The Romans are in charge, they call the shots. He sort of has power, but only because they give it to him and sort of within certain parameters. So they give him the title of king, even though he's legitimately, he's not really the king. The other thing with Herod is that he's not fully Jewish. He's half Jewish, half Edomite, which would have led to the feeling on the street that he wasn't really the legitimate Jewish king. But he manages to ascend to the throne basically because his dad is mates with Julius Caesar. That's the main reason. Now, Herod is a genius architect, very clever bloke. He oversees a range of amazing building projects, some of which are still evident in Israel today. But he's also a lunatic. He kills several members of his own family and hundreds of other people too for very, very minor things. If you know his background, it's not surprising that his reign is characterised by insecurity and paranoia. And that sheds a lot of light on the story that we're about to get into. About that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose and we have come to worship him." So these men from the east show up. We don't know what country they're from. In all likelihood, they're not actually kings like in the school nativity. Matthew uses the word magi, which basically meant magicians or astrologers or experts in weird stuff. Experts in weird stuff. We do know that in the ancient world, it was common in the East to study the stars intently. And remember, there was no light pollution like we would have today, so everything was much brighter in the sky and people would spend a lot more time observing it. And these men were obviously very into all of this. But what did they see? What was this mysterious star that apparently showed up all those years ago? Some people who are expert in this would say it was Halley's Comet, but we know that that passed by in about 11 to 12 BC, which is too early for this story. What's more likely, the experts say, is that Jupiter and Saturn combined in the sky sometime around 7 BC. In Eastern astrological thinking, Jupiter was symbolic for royalty. Saturn was sometimes symbolic for the Jews. Don't know why, but it was for these people. So possibly they looked at this and thought, this means a new Jewish king, and he must be important. Now, this way of thinking, this way of observing the stars and the planets, is not how we think at all with our modern rational scientific minds. And actually, it's not a way that the Bible encourages people to think at all either. But what this may demonstrate is that God worked with the existing beliefs of these men to point them to Bethlehem to go and look for this new baby. This baby was so important, the story is telling us, that God wanted them to be there for reasons we're not quite sure of. So they see this star, well, to them it would have been a star, and we know it's more likely an alignment of planets, and they turn up in Jerusalem, because that's the capital city of the whole nation, and they want to know, where is he? Where's this baby? Show us. King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? Herod's based in Jerusalem, so he finds out quite quickly. Bunch of blokes from the east snooping around looking for a baby king. He's deeply disturbed. Now remember, Herod's not really a legitimate king, and he's certainly not a good one. But he's desperate to hold on to power. So the idea that somebody is looking for a baby and they're describing this baby as king of the Jews is exactly the opposite of anything that Herod ever wants to hear. This is a nightmare situation for him. The big fear for Herod is that if Jesus is meant to be the true king somehow, or even if people think that he is, then he, Herod, isn't, and his family are going to be out of the door. Now, Herod is not particularly religious in the Jewish sense. He knows bits and pieces. And that's why as soon as he hears about the baby, he starts thinking, what's all this, a Jewish king? But you know, I'm the king. And on top of that, at that time, the Jewish people were waiting for a Messiah figure, which they understood from the Old Testament, a Messiah figure, a saviour, a super person who was going to come along. And so when Herod gets wind of this king of the Jews talk, he doesn't ask questions about a king as such. He asks, where's the Messiah supposed to be born? He's very concerned. He puts two and two together. He's thinking, okay, if this is Messiah and he's really great, well, he'll probably be made king if he comes. That's very concerning. But what if this kid is the Messiah? What if he fulfills the Old Testament stuff? That's the thing that I need to worry about. Now, of course, at this point, it wasn't that everybody just had a Bible lying around. They couldn't Google it, of course. So the obvious thing to do from Herod's point of view was ask the Bible experts, the leading priests and teachers of religious law. There were literally thousands of these guys in Israel. They're the cream of the crop that Herod gets in for a chat. The experts of the experts. Now, Herod seems to know that the Old Testament does say that the Messiah was supposed to be born somewhere, but he can't remember where. He doesn't know the detail. So you can just imagine him with all the religious guys gathered around in a huddle, and he's really nervous. Maybe he's wringing his hands. And he says, okay, guys, where's the Messiah supposed to be born? And inside he's thinking, don't say Bethlehem, don't say Bethlehem, don't say Bethlehem. And he's sweating all over. And then comes the reply. In Bethlehem in Judea, they said, for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd for my people Israel. These guys that are answering Herod are experts, remember. They're onto it straight away. Oh, don't worry about it, Herod. We know this one. Don't worry about it. It's Bethlehem in Judea. That's the right answer. Bethlehem in Judea. Just what he does not want to hear at all. And then these experts start quoting an Old Testament book called Micah, which was about 700-800 years old. And in Micah, it says those exact words. The only difference, actually, is that Micah calls it Bethlehem Ephrathah, because there was, as we said, there were several towns called Bethlehem, and he's being specific. But by the time of Matthew, they just refer to it by the region, which was Judea. And the verse in Micah is what has become known historically as a messianic prophecy. That's a very big churchy-sounding term. Basically, it means a prediction or a pointer about the Jewish Messiah that you'll find in the Old Testament. And there's loads of them, hundreds of them. But some of them are much more obvious and clear than others. And Micah chapter 5 verse 2, as we've just read, is one of the most clear. It says this guy, this Messiah, he's going to come out of Bethlehem Ephrathah, Bethlehem in Judea. And it's really specific. It doesn't just say in Bethlehem. It's really specific about which one. And this is remarkable, not just because it's being specific, but also Bethlehem was tiny. It wasn't like Micah was hedging his bets and saying, yeah, let me think. The Messiah will come from somewhere near Jerusalem in that vicinity. No, no, no. He's far more specific than that. One of the many reasons that people believe in Jesus is that he fulfills predictions like this that could not possibly have been engineered on a human level. You can't choose where you're born, right? But as well as this amazing prediction about the Messiah, we could miss the other thing that Micah says. Not just that he'll be born in Bethlehem, but God says he will be a shepherd for my people. He'll be a shepherd for my people. Not a puppet king in it for himself like Herod. This special leader will be more like a shepherd. Someone who serves and protects and fights for the flock that he looks after, for the people that he's with. This is a ruler to be glad about, to be excited about. What's really odd here, though, I think, is how the religious experts react to this conversation. They know the Old Testament thing about Bethlehem. They must have heard about the men from the east looking for a baby king. They're very well versed in all the Old Testament stuff about Messiah, and yet they don't have any interest in this baby whatsoever. They don't bother. I mean, they could walk to Bethlehem from where they are in a couple of hours, maybe. It's not that far. Aren't they interested in at least checking this out, in having a look? It would seem not. We'll touch on that at the end. But for now, that's all that they are in the story. That's their one little cameo in this story. And it continues. Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too." Herod's reaction is just very true to his character. He's really concerned. He's thinking, it could be him. It could be him. It could be the Messiah. He's from the right place. People are already excited about him. And if it's him, I'm in trouble. What am I going to do? So the first thing he does is he gets as much information as possible. Tell me about this star. Come on, wise men, tell me what's going on. And he's very clever. You see, if he sent an army to Bethlehem, then the baby's parents might do a run with him. They might get away. A much better approach is to get the wise men to tell him everything. And he tries to get them on side. Hey, you guys are my friends now. Come back and tell me everything. I just want to worship the baby. That's all I'm after. Can't wait to do that. After this interview, the wise men went their way. And the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Very school nativity, this little bit of the story. So the wise men keep following the star. Eventually, it brings them to Bethlehem. It must have just continued overhead in that direction. And Matthew tells us that as soon as they see the child, they worshipped. And it's quite possible that at this point that Jesus is not a newborn anymore. He's maybe a toddler, up to 2 years old sort of a time. And what I love in this paragraph is you have this astronomical event, this star or alignment of planets, whatever it is, and these men who've travelled for miles and miles, and they bow down in worship because they believe that Jesus is this great king. And yet Matthew includes this little line in the middle, the child with his mother Mary. The child with his mother Mary. He's always telling us throughout this book, Jesus is this great king, and he's God, and he's from up there, but he's also down here with us. He's with us. And in this scene, he's with his mum, who's just looking after him 24/7 because he's a toddler. Now, my son just turned one a few weeks ago, and I can just imagine when the wise men came in, Mary said, right, okay, can you just have him for 20 minutes? I could just do with a bit of time to myself, please. Matthew is telling us that Jesus is the God of the universe, and yet he arrives and he's in all the vulnerability and relatability of a baby boy with a mum who he's completely dependent on at this time. And the wise men bring gifts. And again, if you did the school nativity, you'll know what they are. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But as with everything in these gospel stories, each of the gifts has particular meaning. Gold was a gift for a king. You gave King's Gold and you're on safe ground. It's like buying your mum flowers. It never goes wrong. You always bring gold for a king. Frankincense, less common these days, was used by the priests in the Jewish temple. It was connected philosophically with worship and access to God. That's how people thought of frankincense. Myrrh was a bit less exciting. Myrrh was used to embalm the dead. That's what it was for. Imagine being the guy who brought myrrh as a birthday present for a toddler. Who does that? Well, this guy did. But even these gifts end up telling us something about this baby. He was born to be king. He was born to be the priest who mediated between man and God, so to speak. And he was born to die. Even in the gifts that are brought to Jesus as a toddler, it's clear what his destiny is. Herod has no clue who he's dealing with, and he has no clue what the real king has to do for his people. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. So the wise men go home, and there's this one little line, God warned them in a dream, just don't go back to Herod. Now, if you're somebody who's skeptical about all this Jesus stuff, that probably does sound a bit weird that they had a dream, hard to get your head around. But let's remember, in Jesus, we have someone who, along with being the most compelling person who ever lived and fulfilled dozens of predictions from the Old Testament and was known throughout the region where he lived by his friends and enemies for doing the miraculous. This isn't that much of a stretch. It's just one extra thing. His whole life tells us God is for real. And in the grand scheme of things, giving a few Eastern astronomers a helpful pointer in their sleepy subconscious is not a big feat. But note that while this baby is meant to be the king who dies, it's not time. Herod is not meant to get his grubby hands on this baby, at least at this point. God has this planned out, and it's not in Herod's timing, it's all in his. And you know, interestingly, they've been very heavily involved in just this little paragraph. This is the last thing that we ever hear of the wise men. We know nothing about what happened to them. We know nothing about where they went. We know nothing about what they did with their lives. We know nothing at all about what happens next with them. Herod, we do know a bit more about. He died a few years after this. And the historian Josephus wrote that Herod was so concerned that nobody would mourn his death that he commanded a large group of distinguished men to come to Jericho, which is where he was expected to die. And he gave an order that they should be killed when he died so that the displays of grief that he craved for himself would definitely take place because people would be grieving these other men. Now, his family didn't carry out that wish for some reason, but this is the final thing that tells us the sort of king that Herod was. Paranoid, self-important, all about himself. The king who wants the attention, the king that wants other people to die for him and for his glory. The true king, the real king, the sort of king you actually want, was born to unimportant people in a stable up the road, was a servant, a shepherd, a mediator between man and God. And in death, he didn't seek glory for himself, but sought to bring glory as a gift for the people of God. So that's the story of this little passage. But looking over the whole thing, I reckon this shows us three ways that people might respond to Jesus. And these are ways people have always responded to Jesus, actually. There's the way of Herod, there's the way of the religious leaders, and there's the way of the so-called wise men. And it's mad because whatever else you might say about Jesus, he certainly divides opinion. At this point of the story, he's a toddler. He's little more than a baby. He drools and eats and poos and giggles. And yet people react to him in very extreme ways, even from day one. Firstly, there's outright hostility. Herod's response is pretty straightforward. He's not a fan. He's just outright hostile to Jesus from the beginning. But of course he has his reasons. The thing is, it's not that Herod's done a Bible study and Jesus couldn't possibly be the person that the Old Testament points to. It's not that he's engaged with leading philosophical thinkers and decided that Christianity isn't true. It's nothing like that. Herod is opposed to Jesus because he's afraid. He's afraid that the power that he has, the position he has, the control he has in life will be taken away from him. He wants to be in charge. He wants autonomy. He wants to be king, not only of Israel, but of his own life. And of course, undoubtedly, This is one of the main reasons that people reject Jesus today. On the surface, people will make lots of intellectual claims, lots of arguments, lots of scoffing. But when you drill down, most of the reasons that people have for rejecting Jesus are quite superficial, in most cases, and not based on meaningful thinking and research. I am totally convinced that pretty much all of people's gripes of Jesus are about God and God being in control. We like being in control of our own lives. We think that all the things we set up for ourselves to feel secure will protect us. We fear that if we even entertain the idea of Jesus being someone more than maybe a historical figure, we're going to end up signing our lives away and being miserable forever. Now, I can understand that concern. Your life is an important thing. You wouldn't want to hand control of it just to anybody on the street. But look at Herod's example. He had the dream, so to speak. He was the king of a nation. He was respected. He was bright. He was a man of huge power and influence. But was he ever really in charge? I mean, externally, he had all this power and control, but it never protected him from insecurity and paranoia. His lived experience was still deeply dissatisfying. It wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. In the same way, are you really in control of your life? Really? Our culture is constantly telling you that you are, or at least that you should be. But it's an illusion. Your life and my life are shaped by 1,000 things that we have absolutely no control over whatsoever. For example, like, I don't know, maybe if there was a global pandemic that happened to us or something. So whether you'd call yourself a Christian or not, a follower of Jesus or not, now is a time when many of us are feeling what was always true, the lack of control. And whenever we sense a lack of control in life, we can do one of two things, really, when it comes down to it. One is we can try and wrestle our control back, try and arrange life so that everything works in our way, which even leaders of kingdoms and empires have found to be futile. Or two, we can change our attitude to God, acknowledge that really he's in control, and that actually that's better anyway. It's much better anyway. Look at how he uses that control. Look at what Jesus does. Second way of responding, there's a complacent indifference. They only appeared in the story for a moment, but the religious leaders of Israel don't bother checking out this baby in Bethlehem. They're not interested. How could that even be? These are very, very religious people. They're very intense people. They're very committed to the faith. They know the Bible inside out. They read it all the time. They memorize it. They go to worship services constantly. They pray prayers. They do everything externally that's religious. They think about it. They act it and so on and so on and so forth. But when this baby comes along and there's a bit of buzz, there's a rumor that he's the person that their whole religion is waiting for, they don't even think to check it out. They don't have a look. And this seems very strange, illogical. But actually, this is a very helpful little picture of where religiosity always leads. It's very possible, and I think very common, to be getting on with lots of religious activity, lots of very devout, outwardly serious, self-denying stuff, and yet have no interest in the person of God at all. These Jewish experts, under the surface, under all the outward stuff, they're not actually interested in God. They're not interested in what he's doing. And in reality, they would hate me saying this, but they've been dead for a long time. They're not that different from Herod. Religiosity, separate from God, when it's all about following rituals and ticking off rules and knowing all the right things, and it's not about relationship, it's all about control too. It's about control as well. The idea that God would show up in our world as a baby is a complete affront to our pride, our self-sufficiency, and our religiosity with it. What God does in Jesus means it's not about us. It's not about our ability to be religious. And if you're very, very religious, your performance is your safety blanket. If you're very, very religious, you don't want to face the fact that you can't do it on your own, that you'll never be perfect, that you'll never live up to it. The illusion of control is thoroughly broken. So these guys actually are like Herod, but probably they're in an even more dangerous position to be in, because here and now, if you're a dedicated Christian, you can be so busy being religious that you miss Jesus. You do loads of Christian activities, you get praised for it, Before you know it, your own piety is your focus and your pride, and you didn't even notice. You were too busy being a Christian to focus on Jesus. And so this example, I think, speaks to everybody, to religious Christians and religious non-Christians, and says, don't be so focused on your performance, your theology, your own devout intensity that you miss the wondrous miracle of God that is Jesus coming into our world. If you miss that, you are off track completely. And I would say it like this. I was trying to capture it in one sentence, and it's this. The moment anything about who Jesus is and what he does feels unremarkable to you, you've moved towards complacent religion. We all need that reminder again and again and again and again. But third response, humble joy. And this is where we see what the wise men do. There's a load about them that we don't know. But what we do know is telling. And Matthew does something very deliberate. He's writing as a Jew to introduce Jewish people to Jesus. He believes he's the Jewish Messiah, he's the fulfillment of all this stuff. But at the same time, he wants to make it really clear it's not about being Jewish, which of course was the huge temptation. If you're a religious Jew, you think very quickly you're going to end up humanly just thinking it's all about being Jewish. Being Jewish is everything. That's the temptation. And so Matthew shows us the sort of the secular Jewish authority, Herod, rejecting Jesus. Then he shows us the religious Jewish authority, the chief priests and so on, rejecting Jesus. But the people he shows responding in the right way are not Jewish at all. So he tells us something that would have been shocking to his audience, which was mostly Jewish. Matthew's saying, it doesn't matter your ethnicity or position or how theologically educated you are. It's all about what you do with Jesus. It's all about how you respond to Jesus. These men from the East are excited and they're curious and they're open to something that wasn't safe and familiar to them. They're outside the Jewish bubble that the whole story happens in, but they're gladly welcomed into it. They're people from outside. They have beliefs and practices that would not have been what God commands elsewhere in the Bible. But God starts with them where they are, and he leads them to Jesus through a very weird astronomical thing. They have no control over any of this. They just respond as far as it's up to them. So in them we see the antidote to hostility and indifference. It's acknowledging you're not in control of your life and taking joy in the fact that God is. And he invites you in, whatever your background or ethnicity, your knowledge or your behaviour. What a wonderful thing. This is a brilliant story at Christmas, and it's brilliant in the middle of summer. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much that in Jesus, it's not about how religious we are or aren't. It's not about our performance, our behaviour, our theological insight and knowledge. And I ask that you would give every person listening to this the attitude of those wise men in the story, who, though they were from a far off place and couldn't have understood loads of things that were going on with Jesus, they're curious, they're humble, they come and they see him and they bring what they have. What an amazing example we have in them, Lord. And as I say, we ask that you would help us to follow their example this week. Give us places where we can just be in awe of what you've done through Jesus. Give us reminders, give us even opportunities to talk to other people about it. Amen.